Hey fam, I want to tell you about a new podcast called Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life. We know about people threatening democracy, don't we? But there are also people coming together across racial lines to seize this moment and stretch democracy to serve all of us. Join longtime equity advocate Angela Glover Blackwell for Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life, a podcast that asks, how do we build a radically inclusive, thriving, multiracial democracy, and looks at what one city, Los Angeles, is doing to try to make it a reality. Reimagining Democracy for a Good Life is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love Push Black's Black History Year, you'll love our newest podcast called 2 Minute Black History. In only 2 minutes, you'll hear little-known stories about our people and reclaim the knowledge we need to take action and advance our community. To move towards the future, you've got to look to the past. Learn the history you didn't get in school. Tune in to 2 Minute Black History every Tuesday through Friday, right on the Black History Year feed and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Unseen behind towering prison walls, a heartbreaking reality unfolds for countless Black individuals incarcerated in America. Within those cold confines, they endure a profound sense of disconnection and isolation, feeling adrift, even in the midst of others. But what many fail to realize is that this isolation, like the cruel echoes of history, is not by happenstance. It's a meticulously designed and devastating consequence of incarceration. I'm Jay from Push Black, and you're listening to Black History Year. Like its predecessor, slavery, the U.S. prison system flourishes by locking our people up. According to a 2021 Color of Justice report, 1 in 81 Black adults nationwide are serving time in state prison. Let that sink in. 1 in 81. Ridiculous, right? But that's just the beginning. When we take into account the families who also endure time apart, the impact becomes even more profound. Loved ones go through the devastating consequences of this separation, which affects entire communities on physical, emotional, and psychological, and economic levels. For many incarcerated individuals, separation from their families is an imminent reality, where a simple phone call home could lead to financial ruin. Today's guest, however, innovated a solution to mitigate that isolation and connect incarcerated people with their loved ones. That man is Frederick Hudson. Frederick is a social impact entrepreneur, Air Force veteran, and formerly incarcerated person. During his 4 years in prison, he experienced firsthand the predatory nature of the $1.2 billion inmate communication industry. He chose to turn what was negative into a means to help his community and created a product called Pigeonly that is helping to ensure incarcerated folks have access to others outside those inhumane walls of prison. But before we get into this conversation with Frederick and our producer, Lynn Webb, let's hear today's history story about a man and woman who refused to be separated, not even by slavery. Check this out.
Black love is one of the strongest in the world. We love each other through the toughest of times, and the story of Uncle Levi and Aunt Aggie exemplifies this. Here's how an enslaved couple kept hope alive until they met again. Levi and Aggie lived in Georgia. The two lived on separate plantations, but often saw each other at corn shucking parties. Levi would get a pass to visit Aggie every Saturday night to dance the night away. The pair married in 1843. But their young union wouldn't last. After only a year of marriage, Levi's plantation oppressor moved to a different county and took Levi with him. The separated couple would go on to marry other spouses out of convenience and raise families, but their love for one another remained strong and constant. During Reconstruction, Levi learned Aggie was alive and married. He tried to reach her, but their obligations to their families denied their reunion. As the years went by, their love only grew stronger. As the twilight of their lives approached and their respective spouses passed, Levi and Aggie finally reunited and spent their last years together dancing and playing just as they did in their youth. The story of Levi and Aggie is tragic, yet heartwarming. Despite the myths that Black love isn't real, these two loved one another through the horrors of slavery and emerged together on the other side. Frederick Hudson, what does Black liberation look like to you?
Wow, that's a good question. I think us, you know, Black people having the freedom to move about without the mentality and the mindset of trying to always preemptively determine how am I going to get hindered or thwarted. So I just think about my own journey. I instinctively think of who's going to try to prevent me from moving forward on this, or what do I have to try to go around, or what hurdles I'm going to try to go through. And I think, people from other communities, you know, white people in particular, when they want to build something, just say, okay, I'm gonna build this, right? They're not necessarily playing defense when they start. So I think, you know, Black liberation is a lot of the not having the need to play defense when we want to start or do something. We can just be on the offense and say, you know, I'm going to put a house there. I'm going to put a building there. I'm going to put a business there. And I'm not necessarily thinking about, you know, how I'm going to get hindered in trying to do that, get that progress.
And how would you say that the work that you do aids in achieving or speaks to Black liberation?
Yeah, I think for me particularly, I definitely serve as an example. You know, I served close to 5 years in federal prison for distribution of marijuana, something that's legal, you know, pretty much in major cities all across the country, particularly where I live in Las Vegas. You can go in a store and just buy marijuana, you know, like you go into 7-Eleven and buy a soda. So, you know, after serving federal prison time for that, you know, I saw that there was this population of people, particularly people serving time in prison, that was very difficult for them to stay in touch and for us to stay in touch with our support network of family and friends on the outside. So that's where the idea of Pigeonly was born, and the company that I started, where we built a platform that enables and helps people to search, find, and connect with an incarcerated loved one. And it was all just really trying to, you know, solve the problem that I experienced on a personal level, where it was very difficult and expensive for me to stay in touch with my support network of family and friends. So for me, going through that process and going through incarceration, getting out and starting a business, having to learn the world of the business, having to learn the language of business, having to navigate a space where a majority of people do not look like me and definitely don't have my background, and then have to overcome those things to still bring my vision into the world and build what I thought was needed. I think, you know, definitely have been an example of how to navigate that. And because I was able to get through those doors, I've been able to open up doors for a lot of my peers as well. So that's the biggest benefit for me, is that not only, you know, did this turn into, you know, an era of employment and a way of wealth generation for my support network of family and friends, but also, you know, because of the inroads that I've made, I've been able to open up doors for others that come from my background that look like I look.
I want to dial back just a little bit, because you mentioned going through your history about how you were incarcerated for 5 years for distribution of marijuana. And I'm sure the irony is not lost on you that you were incarcerated for something that is legal in a lot of the United States, including where you live, like you said, in Las Vegas.
The biggest thing is, not only is it legalized, but, you know, the people who have built marijuana, huge marijuana companies. Now, there's more Black people getting involved in it. But in the beginning, when this started happening, it was only white folks in the marijuana business. And they were praised and celebrated for doing the same exact thing that many of us were incarcerated and penalized and fined and jailed for. But it's more of the same narrative. It's more of the same thing when, you know, if I'm white and I say so, right? So if I say it's fine, it's fine. If I say it's not fine, it's not fine, right? So there's really no true rhyme or reason to it, but it's just a systematic system that we live in. That it's okay if they do something. We see the hypocrisy all the time, you know, from everything from interactions with police officers to, you know, interaction with someone at a bank, right? Like we live in two Americas and Black people definitely have a different plight than white America for sure.
I don't want anybody in the audience to be misled. Like, yes, while you serve 5 years for distributing marijuana, but you serve 5 years for sending marijuana, at least from what I was able to glean, through parcel companies. It's not what people may picture. You were an Air Force veteran. You were honorably discharged in 2005. Like, I don't want people to misunderstand. This is totally ironic what happened to you, man.
What our business has expanded to is that we do government contracting as well. And a lot of these prison institutions now pay us for, you know, helping them process the mail that they receive and things like that. So in my way, it was like, okay, yeah, you guys incarcerated me, but now a lot of these same jails and prisons are now paying us. So, I'm definitely going back and making them pay me for it for sure.
Now, you said that the Pigeon League birthed because of your experience being incarcerated and having that separation from your loved ones. And this is something that we as Black people have had to, you know, overcome for years, dating all the way back to the transatlantic slave trade and how they basically tore apart families. Then you had just fast forward to policing and basically the industrial incarceration system and how that pulls apart families. Did any of that history play a part in the idea for Pigeon League?
Because the idea was born out of my personal experience of being incarcerated, I quickly saw the distinction between people who could afford to stay connected and connected with their loved ones and support no one outside, and the people who could not, and the people that I saw could not afford to stay connected. Those were the folks that even in, you know, the 5 years that I was there, I would see leave and come back, leave and come back, leave and come back. And what I didn't know is that just my general observation was backed by, you know, years and years of research that showed that communication is one of the most important factors of recidivism, right? It's a really good indicator of recidivism. And then you say, well, okay, what's the big deal about communication? Well, it's not really the issue about communication. It's the cost of communication.
And when we're talking about the cost, what are we talking about?
So
we're talking
about, you know, during that time, it could be as much as $15 for a 15-minute phone call. And, you know, when you think about the cost of a phone call, we don't even think about the cost of a phone call now, right? Because it's literally pennies on the dollar. It's fractions of pennies to use the phone. Now, when you look at this environment and, you know, you think about, well, why would the cost of prisons phones be so high? And it's mainly driven because the economics. So basically, contracts are awarded to vendors who promise the institution the highest kickback or the highest, what they call commissions. So it creates a system where the bids are awarded to the company that's going to charge the most, because that kickback or that commission that's paid back to the state or paid back to institution, that's not free money. That money is on the backs of the consumers, the people who's paying for the calls. Well, who is paying for the calls? It's not the inmate who's paying for it. It's the mom, the sister, the brother, the cousin, the auntie, the person outside. They're bearing that cost, right? And when you look at the majority of the prison population being Black males, you know, those are most of the times the breadwinners, and those are the economic base for those families. So when you take that out, now you just create this loop where it just becomes very difficult to support. And then what happens is communication starts to deteriorate over the years, because, you know, you just can't afford it. If you have to choose between, you know, a prison phone bill that's a couple hundred dollars, or your light bill, or your water bill, or your cell phone bill, or whatever, you know, it can quickly get cut. So that's really the fundamental issue, which goes back to cost of poverty in America, and the cost of being poor is extremely expensive.
What did that deterioration of the connection, what did that look like specifically for you?
So I was fortunate where my sister, she would faithfully put $150 on my commissary books every month for my entire incarceration, right? That didn't happen for most people. But for my peers, and when you think about $150, you're like, oh, that's not a lot of money. But you know, in there, it's everything, right? That was my ability to use the phone. That's my ability to do commissaries, my ability to use the email system because you pay for everything. So, and then because I had those resources, I was able to use those funds to do my research, to order magazines, to study, and use a lot of the tools that I used when I was released to actually build my business. So, you know, it was a huge benefit to me for that. But when you look at what just, you know, look, you know, my peers and the ones around, folks that are around me, we look at that cost of communication. Just imagine being out of society for 10 years and then being thrown back in, and you've lost touch with all those relationships that we take for granted. So you're looking for a job or you're looking to start a new career. We immediately go to our network. We talk to the people around us. We talk to the people we know. We might have talked to somebody we worked with in the past, somebody we went to school with, et cetera. And you say, hey, this is what I'm looking at. And they say, oh, I know somebody. You can talk to this person. Oh, I know someone. When you completely lose that, it is extremely difficult to get back on your feet. It's extremely difficult when you've lost those touch, when you say when you're first releasing, you need that first couch that you can sleep on until you get on your feet. So this is why that communication is so expensive, it's so important. And this is why when the barriers of communication are so high because they're expensive, you know, relationships deteriorate. Just imagine someone going through something as stressful as incarceration is and not being able to communicate with your children and losing touch with your children. You know, those relationships that, I mean, that's significant. It really tears apart families in a really horrible way. Because, you know, at the end of the day, regardless of what someone did to go in prison, the reality is majority of people do not have life sentences. So that means that they're going to be released at some point in the future. So regardless of how you feel about why they're there, right or wrong, that's irrelevant. I don't even focus on that. The point is this person's going to be released at some point. So the real question is, what type of person do you want to release? Do you want to release someone who has strong family ties and less likely to reoffend? Do you want to release someone who has those relationships necessary to be a productive member of society as quickly as possible? Or do you want to release someone who's isolated, has no one, has no bearing, doesn't have any anchors whatsoever, that is less likely to be successful when they're released, right? So that's the real question. And that's where I focused.
Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
I'm thinking about the reason why, you know, this interview was very like important to me personally is because I have a brother who spent time incarcerated. But in speaking with him, you know, he would talk about how just a letter, he might only get like maybe two letters a month or something like that. But that would be the difference between falling back into some old habits and just holding on and having a connection and knowing that there was someone out there and that there was a system out there for him to return to, that was really all the difference in just getting from the next day to the next day to the next day inside.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, to put it in terms that, you know, we all deal with out here, just imagine you're going through an extremely stressful situation and you can only send a text message that's limited to, let's say you can only send it that's limited to a tweet. That's as much as you can say. And you can only get a response to that tweet within, let's say, 24 hours. And just imagine how frustrating that would be, right? And that's way better than prison communication, right? So that's so I just to give people an idea, just imagine you're dealing with something that's so heavy, you can't see them in person, you can't pick up the phone and call them. And all you can do is write down 160 characters like a tweet. And in order for you to get a response back, it takes 24 hours to even get a response back. And trying to communicate the emotions and the mental health things that you're dealing with and or the significant family issues that, that go on when these events happen. And that's, you're restricted at that level of communication right here in the outside world. Most people would lose their mind with that. They wouldn't be able to cope and communicate with that. Prison is a communication is worse than that, right? You know, so the idea that even as bad as it is, it gets restricted even more, you know, it has significant impacts on families, significant impacts on relationships. Just imagine the person that's married or the person that, you know, the significant other or whoever, or the children is a really good example. Just how to try to navigate that the best you can. It's really tough. It's really hard.
We noted that, you know, sometime like in the early 19th century, I think it was the Auburn State Prison in New York, and even Eastern State Prison here in Philadelphia, because I'm in Philadelphia, they developed like this whole like system for suppressing prisoners' communications, right? That became the standard bearer for how the penal systems were going to suppress prisoner communication. And now, pay it forward, I think there are actually some states that are doing away with receiving actual tangible letters. I think like everything has to be digital or something like that.
Yeah. We're pushing pretty hard against that. So you raised a really good point. It's a form of punishment. And it's a form of, you know, the more I can restrict you, the more I can disconnect you from everything you know and love, the more torment you're going to be in, the more mental anguish you're going to be in, which enhances and increases your level of punishment, right? So the problem is, back to my original point, is that they're doing that to people who are going to be released, right? So it needs to be less about punishment and more about rehabilitation. Get the help that you need. You need to be productive because you're going to be out at some point, right? So, you know, I did time with a lot of people that I want them to get rehabilitated. I don't want them on the streets with my sisters and mother and cousins. I want them to get the help they need so that they can be productive members of the community, because I know they're getting out. That's the difference. I know you will be back out. So that's on one side. And then on the other side is, you know, to your point about, you know, institutions being restrictive, more restrictive, particularly on mail, is that under the guise of preventing contraband, because it is true, contraband, a lot of contraband comes in through the mail, particularly, you know, just how you have opioid abuse and fentanyl, things like that happen on the street. Everything that happens out here happens in there. The problem is with these synthetic-based drugs, it's very easy to incorporate it into paper and ink and then send it in the form of a letter. And because it's so easy to get it in, it's very difficult for institutions to detect it and block it. So I met with the officials in New York regarding Rikers Island. Rikers Island at the time when I met with them, they were on like their 13th death. And I think I was there in like August or something like that of last year. So it had only been 8 months and they already had 13 deaths. And a lot of these deaths were overdose related, right? So this is these substances coming in. These are extremely deadly substances and being consumed. And it's very hard to detect, very hard to block because it's incorporated in paper ink. You can't tell the difference between a fentanyl-laced letter and a regular letter. So institutions have this knee-jerk reaction where we're just going to start restricting mail. But then again, we just already covered the high price of that, the high cost of that. The more restrictive you are, mail is the lowest cost form of communication. You know, all it does is cost a stamp. And you can just send it, you know, it's equal for everyone. And when you restrict that, it makes it difficult. So institutions, because they have this knee-jerk reaction of trying to block and prevent contraband, which is fair, they then start restricting mail or worse, try to digitize it, where they say, well, all mail has to be delivered to a tablet. Well, the problem with delivering mails to a tablet or kiosk or whatever devices they have in institution is that everyone doesn't have equal access to it. And mail is and has always been a constitutional protected right. So it doesn't matter what you did, why you did it, or who you did it to. You have to, as an American citizen, you're constitutionally protected to be able to receive mail, USPS mail. So the problem is when you restrict mail to digitize it and it can only be delivered to a tablet, you don't always have access to a tablet. There was this lawsuit in Florida where the tablet service was out for 2 or 3 weeks, which means no one got their mail. There was a lawsuit in Pennsylvania where they was trying to also scan and photocopy people's legal mail, which is a huge violation of attorney-client privilege. And so when we said, look, we understand the problem of preventing contraband, but we also know the importance of tangible real mail because it's equal for everyone to receive it. And it doesn't require you to have this device that you may or may not have access to 24/7. So that's our push against this whole full digitization of all mail. Number one, all mail should not be digitized, particularly your legal mail, because that's a violation of attorney-client privilege because, you know, things, computers and systems get compromised all the time. That's number one. Number two is when you think about how institutions are built just from an infrastructure type of way. You know, these are concrete steel structures. We barely can get Wi-Fi to work well in our house. Imagine an institution that's 3-4 levels, all concrete and steel, right? How good do you think Wi-Fi is going to work in there? When I say Wi-Fi, just to make sure the audience understands, they don't have access to the internet. This is closed Wi-Fi just for, you know, internal applications like receiving your mail and things like that. There's no internet access in jail, period. But for the network access, I should say, to work for you to be able to view mail on your tablet or view mail on the kiosk, you know, it's spotty at best, which also restricts the constitutional right to have free access to your mail. So those are some of the issues with it. And then there's some places that even have a pay-to-play system where in order for you to be on a tablet, you have to pay to be on a tablet. So now you've monetized again, you know, someone having access to the mail. So those are just a number of problems where, you know, we've took a very strong stance on this and said, look, no one has to pay for anything for mail. They can receive it. If anything, the institution needs to pay for it, but the population should not have to pay for it. And that mail should be delivered. It should be physical in their hand. It doesn't require them to have no additional devices. It doesn't require for them to pay any additional fees. They have free access to mail just like everyone else does in the country.
And that then brings you to the creation of Pigeonly.
Yeah. So basically what we do is, there's two sides of the business. On the consumer side of the business, someone can go on our website, they create an account and they can send, you know, they can create and design a postcard, for example. So our system allows everyone to send a limited amount of mail for free. So that means even if you don't have the money to pay for it, you can send a limited amount free of charge. So you can design a postcard, you know, you put photos on it, put your message on it, and then you can hit send. It'll then be printed out by fulfillment team, which is a full print house similar to like, you know, like a Kinko's or, you know, one of those type of setups. So it'll produce the physical card, it'll ship it out, and then it'll be sent to your incarcerated loved one. If someone wants to create a greeting card, if they want to, you know, send photos from the weekend, they can do the same thing. It'll print out. And it just really is a convenience to save someone from having to go to a Kinko's and print it out themselves or a Walgreens or CVS to print out their photos and then go to a post office. You know, when's the last time you bought a stamp for anything, right? So most people, you know, they don't have the time. And all of us, because we're on the go, we live in this digital world, we're used to doing everything from our phone. This allows you to continue that experience and then upload photos and do whatever you want to do from your phone. Hit the send button, but your loved one will still receive a physical, tangible product. So that's on the convenience side. Now, for institutions that we work with, that we contract with, in addition to that, people also are able just to regular handwrite their letters and send it. We process the letter, make sure it's contraband free, and then we forward that letter onto an institution. So again, if someone just says, you know what, I like to do it the old school way. I don't want to use a computer. I don't want to use a phone. I'm just going to handwrite my letter. That's fine too. It'll go, we process it, and that's sent to an institution, and that's also at no cost to the inmate or family member, to be exact. I realized the importance because, again, I started this company out of my personal experience, so I know everyone can't afford it. However, I do believe that everyone should be able to stay in touch, right? If you have a loved one that is willing to support you through probably one of the most traumatic times in your life of being incarcerated, and I don't want the problem to be, well, I don't have the money to do it, right? So yeah, we won't be able to give you everything, but you know, we can give you a limited amount. At least, you know, you can talk to them at least, you know, 1 to 2 times a month, just to let them know you care about them, let them know that you're there for them. And that can make all the difference. Just someone from the outside reaching in and touching you can make all the difference. So, and again, that's my efforts to, you know, improving and helping recidivism, because I know for a fact, the more we're able to keep people in touch, the less likely people are going to reoffend when they get released. And you know, that's a studied and research backed fact. So, you know, that's the side of our company that is more impact and mission driven, in addition to, you know, us being a for-profit company.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is here to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 15% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Now, we at Push Black, while we definitely support Black liberation, another aspect of that, especially in regards to the prison system, is looking at it from a abolitionist point of view, right? Because we have a belief that the prison system is not necessarily, it's not necessary. How do you feel about that?
That's a good question. Number one, I do think prisons is necessary. There are people, yeah, I mean, and let me put some context to that. So there is a need for correction, and we do need a place in society to put people that we are afraid and cannot live with. Do I think that prisons should be designed the way they're designed, where it's just warehousing humans? Absolutely not. That's what prisons should not be. What it should be is for rehabilitation. However, there does need to be a structure and a system in place where for someone to be rehabilitated for whatever crime they committed, right? Assuming they're not wrongly convicted, assuming, you know, let's use murder, for example. If someone murders an innocent person, you know, that person has an issue. That person needs help, right? We can't take that person and just say, it's fine. Now, do I think there's a point in the amount of years where you start getting diminishing returns? Yes. Putting someone in prison and just basically warehousing them for 20 years does not give you a better person, does not give you a better outcome at all, right? So I think educating folks, I think helping people learn trades, helping people get the mental help. That's something that's not even talked about. Like you see a lot of talk about, education institutions. You see a lot of talk about trades in institution, trade learning different trades. However, there's zero, at least from my experience and what I've seen, zero focus on just the mental health that people need, right? The mental health issues that a lot of inmates have. And that's not being addressed at all. And then to go a step further, even the health issues that exists. You know, there's a number of horror stories that people not getting the medical attention they need, because again, the current construct of prison today is warehousing. You're literally just warehousing people for X period of time, and you feed them, and you barely give them any access to medical care or healthy food or anything, and then you expect that, okay, when your time is up, okay, go out there and be productive. And it just doesn't work that way. It might have been, it's one of those European countries, I think it was Denmark, but they have a very positive model for incarceration, and it's more focused on rehabilitation. And I think that's important. I think, you know, if you have someone who is convicted of sex crimes, you know, that person needs mental health, period. Right? You can't just say, you know, well, you know, there's, you know, just okay, just don't do it again and put it back on the street. No, that person needs mental health. And that person needs structure, and it needs the attention to be able to trust that person in the world with the rest of us again. And I think that's the big part of it, is that giving people the help that they need so that we can trust them, you know, as our neighbors again. We can trust them, you know, around us again. So are tons of people given punishments that don't fit the crime? Absolutely. Particularly Black people, 100%. That happens all the time. You know, federal prisons is a really good example of that, where you had the crack law, where the only difference between crack cocaine and cocaine was baking soda, and it was giving guys significantly more time for that because crack was a Black drug and cocaine was a white drug, right? So some people get slapped on the wrist, and now you see the same thing with opioid addiction, where now they're treated like, oh, they need mental health and they need help. And when Black people have the same addictions, like, no, we're gonna put you in jail for 20 years. So in that regard, the justice system, yes, completely flawed. But we do have to have a system where we can rehabilitate people where they can't bring harm to themselves or the general population. That's for sure.
Have you given any thought personally on your own what that system might look like?
I think it's more of a secure campus type of feel. So I'll tell you like what I've seen. So when I first went in federal prison, they have like four different security levels. So the first one is called the penitentiary, or that's high. Then you have a medium, and then you have a low. And the fourth one is the prison camp. So the big difference between the penitentiary, or the high, and the prison camp, which is the lowest you can go, is that on, you know, you see a penitentiary, there's huge walls, barbed wire fences, is this massive, huge thing, right? Nothing gets in or out, right?
Right. It's probably what people think exactly. of when they think of.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. So all the stereotypes when you think of prison, that's what it looks like. Right. And then you have the camp, which camp looks like a college campus. Right. The only thing separating you from walking off, there's a red painted line, and it's just understood, do not cross this line. Right. And yeah. And that's where all your white collar crime goes. That's where, you know, assuming you don't have a violent crime or anything like that, you know, your last part of your sentence, it'll be served there if there's room and accommodations, etc. So now these camps, you know, they're really focused on you're probably a year from being released, 6 months from being released, and these camps are usually situated in places where you're supporting something else. So for example, a lot of times the prison camps will be situated on military bases. So you might be the lawn service for the military or some sort of maintenance workers, etc. That contrasts to the penitentiary, oh, there's nothing. You're on 23-hour lockdown. You barely get an hour of sunlight a day, and it varies depending on what's going on. So now, are there violent offenders that need more security? Absolutely. Are there offenders that are not violent that don't need as much security? Absolutely. I think there should be levels of security as far as you have to build the idea of trust. So the less we can trust you, the more security you have. The more we can trust you, the less security you have. But what they all should have in common is that the fundamental point of it is rehabilitation. So you're going to get the mental health that you need. We're going to, you know, feed you better so that, you know, because you think better when you eat better and you're healthy. So we're going to feed you better. We're going to not house you in inhumane conditions. There's prisons in Louisiana and other hot states that don't have air conditioning, that don't have clean running water. Like, we're going to house you in humane situations where you can start learning and getting the help you need to be a positive member of society. We're going to give you access to trades. Like in federal prison, they would do trades where you could become electrical journeyman. You could be a carpenter journeyman, plumbing, and the list goes on and on. They even had guys that were doing CDL licenses, right? So those are things that I think can be helpful. We had a guy that was, when I got down to the low, we had a guy that was volunteering from Eastern Arizona College when I was in Safford, FCI, which was a federal prison, the low. So I wasn't at the camp yet, but I was between the medium and the camp. And this guy would come in and he would teach us how to use Microsoft Excel, how to use Microsoft Word. I use that every day now, but I learned that in jail. So again, that was something that I was able to use my time, and something that could be forward, that could be forward looking, and that could be a benefit to me, versus me just sitting, being locked in a cage and playing cards and just waiting for my time to expire, with me not coming out any better than I went in, right? They started me at a high only because of my age. When I was incarcerated, I was 23. So because I was 23, they assumed me to be more wild and rowdy. So they're going to put me in a high. Does someone who has a 5-year prison system should be sharing a cell with someone who has a life sentence, who has really nothing to live for? Maybe not. I don't know. Like that.
That doesn't sound equitable to me.
They got it wrong with me, right? So they get that classification wrong. So I guess my point would be, we do have to have a system in place. We do have to have a structure in place. I think if we led with rehabilitation versus just housing, I think if we made investments in that, I think that would be a better return investment for society as a whole. Because again, majority of people are coming home. At some point or another, they will be on the streets with you. So the person that had that sex crime, the person that had that violent crime, the most heinous things we can think that we saw in news that what people have done, we want that person to get the mental health what they need. Right. So, you know, to say that we should just get rid of prisons, I don't know if I agree with that, because there is a place for it. Again, I've lived with people in there that I would not want next to you for your own sake. So it's just like, you know, it's a place for it. But there also was not getting the mental health they need. I don't think we should give up on humans, period. I just don't think we should give up on them.
The part about they are coming home. Most of them are coming home someday. And when you look at it from that point of view, that definitely should, at least for me, play a part in altering your perception on things. And I'm sure it helps to keep your eye on the prize by having a team of individuals, many who share a similar story to you.
Absolutely. So about a half of our team are previously incarcerated. So they definitely understand and are dedicated. And they've really been dedicated. You know, we've been lucky enough to, you know, most of the people we have now have been with us from the beginning. So they've been with us for the long haul. And we have, you know, previously incarcerated in every department. So from engineering to customer service to operations, everywhere. So, and that's important. That's important for us because, you know, they understand why we do what we do. And I also, you know, I wanted us to serve as an example of the amount of talent that's getting released. There's about 60,000 people that's being released from correctional facilities every year. And I think it's important for people to look at the returning citizens as talent. There's a lot of talent that's coming out, a lot of brilliant people that's coming out. Some of the most brilliant minds I've met have been incarcerated, that I met while I was incarcerated. And I think helping people point that talent in the right direction and helping them learn the language and whatever, fill whatever gaps they need to fill, could really do a lot for a business, for a small business. So I think I always push and promote that because I think that's really important.
What can we do, or what role should we play in supporting incarcerated persons?
I think it can be very basic things. So for example, if you personally know someone that is currently going through that, reach out to them, you know, let them know that you're thinking about them, let them know you crossed their mind. You know, that can make a huge difference if they're currently doing time. If someone who is already released and trying to get their life back together, be a reference, you know, help them, you know, let them know if your job is hiring. Most folks that want to get their life together, they're going to outperform because they have more to lose. And so don't be afraid to extend a helping hand. Will you get it right all the time? No. But the people who aren't incarcerated, you refer them and they don't get it right all the time either, right? So this just try to remove the stigma from whatever that past may be and just focus on the fact that they're here now. And the whole goal is to be a productive member of society and to not reoffend, right? So I think it's small things that can be done. If you're an employer, you know, and you're looking for talent, you know, don't overlook the probation officers. The probation officers, they have tons of people who are actively looking for jobs that have to get jobs even as a condition of their probation. So, you know, I think those are very simple things that just people overlook. I think, you know, when it comes to legislation, be involved. You know, there's, you know, you'll split the room when if you ask people, like, you know, how much power does our vote have? But I think withholding votes are just as powerful as giving votes too. And I think to put the people that we want, that cares about the issues of Black folks is really important. And I think we need to be more deliberate and bold about that as well. And also people who just care specifically about Black issues, not just the, you know, we're going to help everybody type approach. I mean, that has its place. But I also think, you know, us supporting the people that are particularly bold and unapologetic about dealing with Black issues in America. That's who we really need to put our full support behind.
Thank you, Frederick, for taking the time to speak with us today on Black History Year.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was Frederick Hudson, creator of Pigeonly. To get started with Pigeonly or learn about the projects underway, visit www.pigeonly.com.
At Push Black, we agree with Marcus Garvey when he said, "A people without knowledge of their past, history, origin, and culture is like a tree without roots." We believe telling empowering stories on Black life and history can build a more liberated Black future. Being here with us lets us know you probably feel like that's important too. You matter. Your choice to be here matters. It lets us know that you value this work. And you make Push Black happen with your contributions at blackhistoryyear.com. Most people do $5 or $10 a month, but really, everything makes a difference. Thank you for supporting the work. Black History Year is a production of Push Black, the nation's largest nonprofit Black media company. Our team includes Tariq Alani, Brooke Brown, Tasha Taylor, Somalia Rahman, Amber Davis, and Darren Wallace. Producing this episode, we have Sydney Smith and Lynn Webb for Push Black, and Ronald Young Jr., who also edits the show. Black History Year's executive producers are Lily Werkna and me, Julian Walker. Peace.